Couple more things about this diagram here. First is, I think I briefly mentioned already that as we progress along these stages towards shamatha, and as our attention improves, what you notice is that the sense faculties begin to become dormant, to shut down. Which means that if we're actually using the sensations of the breath as the object, at some point we'll need to shift, change that. And so I'd like to describe what happens there if we're using a physical object such as the breath as the object for shamatha practice. Because eventually we have to move to a mental object. And so again, I'll just read a little bit from Alan Wallace's book regarding that. And that's on page 64. He says the following. In the phases of mindfulness of breathing thus far, you have been attending in various ways to the tactile sensations of the respiration. However, to continue all the way along the path of shamatha, eventually you must shift your attention from the tactile sensations of breathing to an acquired sign, a symbol of the air element that appears before the mind's eye as you progress in shamatha practice. So acquired sign, again, is something related to the air element, but it's a mental image. And he says the following. He says, to different people, acquired signs associated with the breath practice may appear like a star, a cluster of gems or pearls, a wreath of flowers, a puff of smoke, a cobweb, a cloud, a lotus flower, a wheel, or the moon or sun. The various appearances of the acquired sign are related to the mental dispositions of individual meditators. If you wish to continue on the path of mindfulness of breathing, which here explicitly turns into mindfulness with breathing, as soon as such a sign arises, shift your attention to this sign. This will be your object of attention as you proceed along the rest of the 9 stages leading to shamatha. At first, your sign will arise only sporadically, so when it disappears, return to the previous sensations of the breath. But eventually, it will appear more regularly and steadily, and from that point onward, focus your attention on this object. As you progress in this practice, increase the duration of your sessions for as long as you're able to maintain a quality of attention relatively free of laxity and excitation. So it seems like for different meditators, again, this acquired sign looks very differently depending on the meditator, and I think it seems to appear to different meditators at different stages. It's not always at the same point of these 9 steps. And I think this is a little bit what some person was trying to explain to me many years ago when I first did a Goenka Vipassana retreat. After that, this person was saying to me, did you see the blue light? I'm going, what are you talking about, blue light? So maybe he was talking about this acquired sign. And then there's something else which happens when we actually achieve shamatha based on the breath. So again, I'll just read from here about that. That's on page 157. And he says the following. The Theravada tradition gives this specific description of achieving shamatha by way of mindfulness of the respiration. You begin this practice as described earlier by focusing on the tactile sensations of the breath, which are the sign for preliminary practice. Eventually you shift your attention to the acquired sign of the breath, which becomes your meditative object until you achieve shamatha, at which point a third sign appears spontaneously. This is called the counterpart sign of the breath, which is a subtle, emblematic representation of the whole quality of the air element. Buddhaghosa described this sign as follows. So Buddhaghosa was one of the most well-known Indian masters within the Theravada tradition. He said the following. The counterpart sign appears as if breaking out from the acquired sign, and 100 times, 1,000 times more purified, like a looking glass disc drawn from its case, like a mother of pearl dish well washed, like the moon's disc coming out from behind a cloud, like cranes against a thundercloud. Very poetic. But it has neither color nor shape. It is born only in the perception of in one who has obtained concentration, being a mere model of appearance. So that's a little bit about how to use the breath to move to shamatha. One more point, and then I want to talk about using the mind as the object of practice. So in this chart here, we see right up at the end, there's one more diagram with number 32, 33. So here we see the meditator with a sword in their right hand. And so this is the sword of wisdom. So this diagram is representing the Vipassana practice, you know, the sword of wisdom to cut ignorance. And so if we look at 32 and 33, the numbers on the opposite page, it says, the root of samsara is cut by the union of shamatha and vipassana observing emptiness. Equipped with mindfulness and introspection, seek the correct view of emptiness. So what this is saying is that in order to cut the root of samsara, which of course is ignorance, we need this union of shamatha and vipassana. That if we don't have this union and we only do vipassana practice, we don't have this stable, clear mind, we won't be able to cut ignorance. All the best we can manage is that the power of our meditation will maybe subdue or can keep the lid on our mental afflictions a little bit. So that's why it's described in this way here. So it says, equipped with mindfulness and introspection, seek the correct view of emptiness. So here, of course, it's talking about the Vipassana practice. And now, of course, we can see the flame again. So the flame means now we need to put effort into investigating the nature of reality. Now, of course, what this doesn't mean is that before we begin Vipassana practice, we have to achieve shamatha. We can do Vipassana practice now, of course. But what it does mean is that if we don't at least have some stability and clarity of mind, our Vipassana practice won't get very far. And that if we really want the Vipassana practice to be able to cut ignorance, we need a very stable, clear mind of shamatha. Okay, so that's all I wanted to really mention about this chart here. And now I want to talk about how to use the mind as the object of shamatha practice. But before I do that, is there any last questions about this chart that's not clear?
Any significance of the hows and the tree?
The house down the bottom?
Yeah.
Not really. It's apart from it's like the meditator coming out of the house. Maybe it's talking about moving into a more spiritual lifestyle, more meditative lifestyle. I'm not really sure.
The tree, where
the monkey's sitting in. Well, the only significance that I know about is that the monkey is sitting in the tree holding the fruit. Meaning, and that is symbolizing again, as we saw, the fact of virtuous thoughts in the shamatha practice are an obstacle. More than that, I don't know. I've not heard any explanation. Maybe just to make the diagram look nice. I don't know.
About what you were referring when to something that the blue light, something like that.
Oh, the acquired sign, yeah.
Yeah. So is this something that goes in your mind, or you imagine instead of the breathing, you see that?
Yeah, that's what it's saying, is that at some point along the path here, and it seems to vary from one meditator to another, but somewhere generally in the middle part at least, this appearance, it's a mental image, will spontaneously appear. and it's related to the air element. And it said that when it appears, you switch from focusing on the sensations to that. But initially it won't be stable, so it'll probably go away. Then you go back to the breath again. And you keep doing that until this becomes stable. And then you use that the rest of the way to the shamatha as the object. Because actually as you move along the higher stages, due to the improved focus of your mind, your sense faculties actually sort of become dormant. They shut down in the middle of the meditation.
So you have to go naturally, not to imagine something.
No, it's not imagining. It comes spontaneously. It's not like you have to think of something. No,
yeah.
No. It just comes automatically at some point. And what appears depends on the background, the physical makeup of the meditator. You know, Alan Wallace, he mentioned many different sun, moon, cobweb, star, all sorts of things. So, but it'll spontaneously appear. Anything else? Okay. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, there's two things here. One is the amount of effort you need to put in meditation. And I think 20 minutes a day is not going to get you that far. I mean, it might get you a couple of stages. But so you need to put more effort into that. But also, I think, as you mentioned, it's very important if we really want to move through this to also engage in these intensive retreats in a group mode or in a solitary mode from time to time as well. And then, of course, on top of that, we need to make sure that we have a conducive lifestyle, you know, supportive lifestyle to this practice. Otherwise, we're going to, whatever benefit we get from the practice, it's going to be overturned by our dysfunctional lifestyle, distracted lifestyle. So that's why it's also important in our daily life to have that supportive lifestyle and continue to work on particularly mindfulness throughout the day. And if we do that and just put as much as effort we can, then I think what you will find is that as our life starts to shift and change, then maybe our priorities start to shift and change because we see they're more benefit in doing these sorts of things rather than lots of other things that we now put a lot of effort into. So even though now you may find that we don't have enough time or enthusiasm for this, but I think as we get into the practice and we see really the benefits and we start to see some tangible benefits, I think maybe the way we approach our life could shift, and that could be make it more supportive, more enthusiasm for doing this practice as well. So again, we, you know, of course, if we grasp onto the result, you know, we may think, oh no, that's just too difficult for me, and then just sort of say, well, I won't bother. I think this would be a big mistake because whatever effort we put into this practice, we'll get that benefit. So, you know, I think we can sort of look at it in this way, is to understand the goal, the process, and then whatever effort we can manage, put that in, and then we'll get that reward from that. And then as we progress, then shift and change and so forth. And, you know, even though we find it difficult now, again, you know, Shanti Deva's advice, you know, no matter how difficult something seems, everything with practice becomes easy. And it's the same. Whenever we learn something new in our life, sometimes we go, oh, that's just so difficult, you know. Like maybe even learning to drive the car. We first jumped in the car, we go, oh no, that's too complicated. And now, of course, it's just automatic because we've practiced. And so same with this. It's just a matter of practice.
The four levels of concentration come after the shamatha.
Mm-hmm.
Has its own sort of path of learning?
Yeah, I mean, there are, you know, you can, in the meditation text, there's a very, very precise description about these four levels, and how to move from one level to the other and so forth. But I think that's a little bit beyond the scope of this, what we're doing here.
And the Pada Shabda, is it both in Theravada and Mahayana, or is it?
So again, you won't really see so much about the word Shamatha in Theravada, because this Shamatha is like the sort of the step below the first jhana, and so really they just talk about the jhanas in general. So again, I think you don't see so much in the Theravada about it. But of course, we're talking about the same practice in terms of developing concentration. How it's described and so forth may be a little bit different, but essentially it's the same sort of practice. And again, in all Buddhist traditions, I think they really emphasize focusing on the breath, overcoming dullness and distraction, using mindfulness and introspection. So these are all very common things. And of course, what I read out now about the acquired sign is coming from the Theravada tradition, in fact. Buddha Gosa is one of the main commentators, Indian commentators, that are used by the various Theravada traditions.
On that note, so in Theravada tradition, how does Vipassana relate to the four jhanas?
So again, like, for example, the Goenka retreat. You know, it's called a 10-day Vipassana retreat. But technically, it's not a 10-day Vipassana retreat, because for the first 3 or 4 days, you're doing shamatha practice. I mean, you're doing anapanasati, focusing on the breath here. 4 days, that's it. 10 hours a day. Nothing but that. Because he understands that's coming from the Burmese tradition, that if you don't put any effort into the shamatha practice, then you do Vipassana, it's not going to work. That's why they spend nearly 4 days just doing the shamatha practice, or the concentration practice. Anapanasati, you know, mindfulness of breathing, focusing here. So that after 3 or 4 days, hopefully the mind has settled down a bit, a little bit more stable, more clear. Then for the next 5 or 6 days, then you do the Vipassana practice. And again, the Vipassana practice, coming from the Theravada tradition, are these three insights of impermanence, dukkha, and no self. And in that 10-day retreat, of course, it's an introductory retreat. So they're primarily working on the first of the three, impermanence. So the way that impermanence is worked on there is by scanning the body for physical sensations and noticing these physical sensations, not reacting to them, and just noticing that they're rising, passing, rising, passing, rising, passing, rising, passing. And so this is that's why the word that Goenka uses the most in the whole retreat is anicca, 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 because he's trying to get us to understand impermanence through the physical body. Of course, then, if people have that experience and understand that things are really flowing at the physical level, then they can understand that any pleasant experiences they have are just fleeting, they're just finishing all the time. And if people are intuitive, they can really then understand that there's nothing out there, stable, lasting happiness to be found. So then they could come to have a little bit of a realization of dukkha, you know, the unsatisfactory nature of this existence, simply from that. And then even more than that, it's possible through that practice to intuitively have this experience of no self. Because if you see our sense of self is often based on a solid sense of body, you know, this is solid body me here. And in this practice, of course, when you're scanning the body, then, and you have good mindfulness, instead of experiencing a single solid body here, what you notice is that there's just a constant flow of sensations. This is flow. So the solid sense of body, if we have good concentration, can collapse. And then the solid sense of me can collapse. But a little bit unfortunately, of course, there's no discussion about this in that course, because that's not the emphasis of it. And so some people who have that experience, and I had that experience in the first time I did the retreat, is people freak out often because this solid sense of body collapses, so the solid sense of me collapses, and then people have a lot of fear because they feel like they're going out of existence. But actually it's a valid experience of no self. But because there's no framework really talked about so much, then people don't know how to interpret that experience. And so they often interpret it as if they're going out of existence and then they have a lot of fear. And I've talked to quite a number of people who've had that experience to the point where they've stopped practicing because they had this fear. They didn't know what that was all about. So again, the only thing is that there was not really a framework because that wasn't the emphasis for the retreat. The emphasis is really the first point, the anicca, the impermanence. So this is how these relate, is that if we don't do those 3 or 4 days of anapanasati, the shamatha or concentration practice, then it would be difficult to do the vipassana practice because we're just going to get caught up in distractions, reactions, and it wouldn't really work in that way. Okay, let's move on now and look at the shamatha practice based on using the mind. And then also a little bit this resting in the awareness. And the reason I'm really wanting to put a little bit of time in that just now before lunch is that two reasons. One is that I think this practice as a shamatha practice itself can be very beneficial for many of us. Because again, we tend to be the slaves of our mind, overwhelmed by our mental content. So this practice will help us to develop the ability to be the observer or the witness, to become the masters of our mind. So there's that direct benefit. But secondly, this practice of looking at the mind and also the third practice, the awareness of awareness, even though they are both shamatha practices, that if we do them well, we can actually, because we're sort of looking at the mind or resting in the mind, if we're very intuitive, we can actually start to realize the deeper nature of the mind, the emptiness of the mind from this shamatha practice. So they're a very good bridge into the vipassana practice. So that's the other reason I want to talk about it a little bit now. So the first practice that I want to look at is observing the mind as the object. Now, here, then, how that differs from the breath practice is a little bit that in the breath practice, of course, thoughts are obstacles. If a thought arises, we need to let it go and come back to the breath. Let it go, come back to the breath. But in the mind practice, thoughts are not problems, meaning we're not trying to make the mind still. Whether the mind is still or there's lots of things appearing in the mind, it doesn't matter. So thoughts are not problems in this practice. What is the problem, of course, is grasping onto the thought and getting carried away by it. That's what. So in this mind practice, so in the breath practice, we have to let go of thoughts and come back. In the mind practice, you let them be. Meaning, don't follow them and don't try to get rid of them. Just simply let them be and simply watch them as they arise and pass, arise and pass. And of course, every time we do that, we're not feeding these thoughts. And our mind will naturally become more still. And also what you find the difference is in the breath practice, the shamatha path is normally in this way, described in this way, these 9 stages. These are called the 9 mental abidings, meaning we're trying to make the mind abide better and better on the object of the breath. Whereas when we look at the shamatha practice of observing the mind, then the perspective is a little bit different. This is more from the mind perspective, abiding better on the object. Whereas in the mind practice, looking at the mind, we more have the event perspective, meaning how are the events unfolding in the mind? And so normally, rather than this 9-stage model, when we use the mind as the object, we see a 4-stage model. And that is that at the first stage of this practice of looking at the mind, what you notice is that there's a waterfall of thoughts crashing down, meaning one thought after the other, just constant mental activity. And the analogy there is it's like a waterfall crashing down on us. But if you continue to watch all these mental events unfolding rapidly, then by not getting caught up in them, then they'll start to quieten down. So the second stage of practice is, instead of a waterfall of thoughts, it's more like a fast-flowing river. And then if we continue to simply watch this mental events, not getting caught up and not feeding it, then the fast-flowing river at the second stage, at the third stage, will become a very slow-moving river, meaning you're going to really notice gaps between when one thought finishes and the next thought starts, and the thoughts won't be so forceful anymore. And if we continue to watch these thoughts, then all mental activity will die down, and then the slow-moving river at the fourth stage will empty into a still lake or ocean. So it's waterfall, fast-flowing river, slow-moving river, into a still lake, which is, of course, symbolizing the shamatha state. So generally, that's how the shamatha path is described when we use the mind as the object in that way. Now, let's have a look at this shamatha practice, because we did that a little bit this morning. I think Jonas briefly introduced it. Also, I led a little bit of a shamatha practice looking at the mind. And many of you probably found that quite difficult. But let's explain a little bit more about the practice, because now in the morning practices, you're going to continue with Jonas to work on that before breakfast. So again, I'll use this book here to describe the practice a little bit. So this is on page 83. And he says, the object of mindfulness in this practice of settling the mind in its natural state, so he calls this practice of observing the mind settling the mind in its natural state, is no longer the subtle sensations of the breath at the nostrils, but the space of the mind and whatever events arise within that space. The object of introspection, as in the earlier practice of mindfulness of breathing, is the quality of the attention with which you are observing the mind. As you venture into this practice, I would encourage you to memorize these quintessential instructions. Settle your mind without distraction and without grasping. Practicing without grasping means not allowing your mind to be carried away by thoughts and sense impressions. Be present here and now, and when thoughts arise pertaining to the past or future, or ruminations about the present, don't be abducted by them. As you hike on this trail of shamatha, don't be a hitchhiker catching a ride with any of the thoughts or images that whiz through your mind. Rather, be like a kestrel hovering motionlessly as it faces the wind, slightly moving its wings and tail feathers to adjust to changes in the currents of the air. Even when your attention is settled in the present, you may still grasp onto the appearances to the mind. Whenever you prefer one mental object over another, whenever you try to control the contents of the mind, and whenever you identify with anything at all, grasping has set in. Here is the challenge at hand. Be attentive to everything that comes up in the mind, but don't grasp onto anything. In this practice, let your mind be like the sky. Whatever moves through it, the sky never reacts. It doesn't stop anything from moving through it. It doesn't hold on to anything that's present, nor does it control anything. The sky doesn't prefer rainbows to clouds, butterflies to jet planes. Whatever comes up in the field of awareness, without distraction or grasping, just let it be. So again, in this practice, we're not trying to make the mind still. If you've ever tried to make your mind still, you know it just does not work. We just get more agitated, more things. So we're not trying to get rid of thoughts or memories or emotions. So if we're observing the mind, and if there's nothing there, just observe that stillness, that space, And if something appears in that space, simply watch it as it arises and as it passes, without trying to get rid of it, without grasping onto it and following it. A little bit more advice about the practice. And so this is on page 101. When you first begin the practice of settling the mind in its natural state, you may have difficulty identifying the intangible domain of the mind. Or even if you do settle your awareness there, after some time, your attention may become vague, disoriented, or spaced out. If you have difficulty identifying the domain of the mind or sustaining attention there, consciously bring up a thought such as, "What is the mind?" and attend to it. Don't think about this question or try to answer it. Just observe the thought itself, watching it emerge in the field of consciousness and then dissolve back into that space. Once it's gone, keep your focus right where the thought was and see what comes up next. If you slip back into a kind of lax, mindless vacuity, deliberately generate the thought again and observe it with bare attention. When you become familiar with this practice, you will no longer need to generate such a thought to crystallize your awareness and locate your attention. That will happen by itself as thoughts arise and pass of their own accord. A little bit more, but just a comment first. So usually when people start this practice, there's two main common experiences. One, of course, is they try to watch their mind and they're just constantly carried away, constantly carried away, constantly carried away. So if this is your experience, again, we need to be patient with ourselves and not get frustrated, because this getting carried away is like the first stage of the breath practice, is that we're just noticing how much we are the slaves of our mind. So rather than getting frustrated, be happy that we're coming to see that how out of control our mind is, how much we are the slaves of our mind. And so again, very patiently is when we notice that we've been carried away, let go of grasping and just come back again. And when we get carried away, let go of grasping and come back again. And not to have some unrealistic expectation that we can stay there and not get carried away. Because, in fact, for the last 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years, we've been allowing the mind to be in control. We've simply always followed our thoughts and emotions. So we've developed a very strong habit to do that. That's something that's going to take time to change. So don't have this unrealistic expectation you'll be able to sit there and watch and not get carried away. And again, just Shanti Deva's advice, no matter how difficult something seems, everything with practice becomes easy. We just need to develop a new habit, which will take time. So that's if we're constantly getting carried away. It's just notice that, let go of grasping and come back, let go and come back, let go and come back. Keep doing that. The other experience that is very common is that people sit and look and nothing seems to be there. What's going on? My mind is usually full of thoughts, but now I'm looking at it and there's nothing there. Now, that's usually because of one of two reasons. One reason is that because our mind is not very clear, there is in fact a lot of mental activity going on, but it's sort of below the level of our radar, the threshold. It's a little bit like now you're focusing here. There is sensations going on here all the time, but when we start to focus here, we may notice nothing or hardly anything. And that's only because our mind is not clear enough to notice all the subtle sensations there. Likewise, when we look at the mind, because our mind is not very clear, there's often quite a lot of subtle mental activity there that we don't really notice. So again, we just need to be patient and stay there. And like the breath, after some time, we're going to start to notice this subtle mental activity. But then again, of course, we're sitting there and looking, and then we're actually thinking, there's nothing there. But isn't that a thought? Isn't that a thought that there's nothing there? And also, if we're finding that we're getting frustrated, just observe the frustration, because that is mental content. So whatever is there, if we're feeling frustrated or whatever there, just watch it. Another reason that often when we look, nothing much seems to be there is, again, because our habit in general in daily life is that when we need to concentrate on something, we have to forcibly concentrate because our mind is sort of chaotic, out of control. And so again, here, the tendency can be is that knowing that our mind is completely out of control, that to look at the mind, we have to do it very forcibly, tightly. And of course, if we do that, then we are putting a lot of effort into mindfulness, meaning the bandwidth of our mind is taken up by mindfulness. So we're really suffocating all the other mental events because we're so intent on the mindfulness. So if that's the case, what we need to do, if we notice we're being intense in our focus, is relax, relax, allow some space for these mental events to come up. But again, here's the very delicate balance, because if we relax too much, if we're too tight, of course we get agitated and we suffocate. So again, we have to balance. And again, this is something that will take time to train in. It's not something that will be easily done. But again, whatever effort we put into this practice, we're going to reap the benefit. We are going to notice that we're not going to be so much the slave of our mind. We're going to become more the masters of our mind. And we're going to start to notice little things first. You know, for example, you know, little things like that used to irritate you don't seem to irritate you anymore because you're sort of looking at these things. Or if you notice a little bit of irritation come up, rather than getting caught up in that, you'll just notice that irritation and go, oh, that's interesting. And then it'll pass and you won't get caught up so much in it. So you'll start to notice little things first. So anyway, there's a little bit more here that can be helpful. He says, the practice of attending to the space of the mind and whatever events arise there is like taking a naturalist's field trip into the wilderness of your mind. When you first embark on this inward journey, you may perceive very little. But as you grow more accustomed to the practice, you will begin to identify an increasing quantity and range of mental phenomena. Some of them are discrete, like thoughts and images, while others are nebulous, like emotions and moods. This practice provides you with experiential access to a domain that cannot be observed with any of the instruments of modern science or technology. The most they can do is detect the neural and behavioral correlates of the phenomena you are observing directly. You have become a naturalist of the mind, and a whole new world is opening up to you that for most people remains largely unconscious. In this practice, the locus of awareness gradually descends from the superficial level of coarse mental activity that is immediately accessible through introspection down into the inner recesses of the mind that are normally below the threshold of consciousness. You discover in this training that the border between conscious and unconscious mental events shifts in relation to the degrees of relaxation, stability, and vividness of attention. Especially when you engage in this practice for many hours each day, for days, weeks, or months at a time, you dredge the depths of your own psyche. In doing so, you remember long-forgotten experiences, both pleasant and unpleasant, and a wide range of desires and emotions. What happens here is a kind of luminously clear discerning, free association of thoughts, mental images, memories, desires, fantasies, and emotions. You are plumbing the depths of your own mind, undistracted by external diversions. Once hidden phenomena are unmasked through the lack of suppression of whatever comes up. This is potentially an extraordinarily deep kind of therapy, and the more intensely you practice it, the more important it is to proceed under the guidance of an experienced, compassionate teacher. During your meditation sessions, internalize the wisdom of this contemplative tradition and make sure you implement the core instructions of the practice, which are, whatever arises in the mind, do not be carried away by it and do not grasp onto or identify with it. Just let it be. Watch thoughts, feelings, or other mental events arise. With discerning intelligence, be aware of their nature and let them slip back into the space of awareness without any judgment or intervention on your part. This is the key to letting the knots of the psyche unravel themselves as the extraordinary healing capacity of the mind reveals itself. This is the path to deep sanity. One more thing I want to mention about the practice, and then maybe there's a few questions, and that is regarding the eyes. In the practice, what to do with the eyes. In general, in meditation, of course, the general recommendation is to have the eyes slightly open to let a little bit of light in. Because again, if we have our eyes closed, that's usually a signal that we're going to go to sleep and we get very dull. And if we have our eyes too open, maybe too much light, then we become agitated. So generally it's recommended to have them slightly open. In this practice, it is very much recommended to have the eyes open. And again, I'm going to read from here as to why that is the case, and then I want to make a little bit of personal comment on that. And the instruction from the meditation manuals is, let your gaze be vacant. And then Alan Wallace is commenting on that. He says, this again, page 86, 87, in this practice, it is important that your eyes are open, vacantly resting your gaze in the space in front of you. If you have not meditated with your eyes open, you may find this uncomfortable, but I encourage you to get used to it. Blink as often as you like, and don't strain your eyes in any way. Let them be as relaxed as if you were daydreaming with your eyes open. By leaving the eyes open, while focusing your attention on the domain of mental events, the artificial barrier between inner and outer begins to dissolve. Especially in our materialist society, we have gotten used to the idea that our thoughts and all other mental events are inside our heads. But this has never been demonstrated scientifically. All that is known in this regard is that mental events are correlated with neural events, but that doesn't necessarily mean they are located in the same place. Even without this materialist assumption that the mind is nothing more than a function of the brain, we naturally have a sense that we are looking out on the world from behind our eyes. But this sense of an independent subject or ego inside the head is an illusion. There is no scientific support for such a belief, and when it is inspected through rigorous contemplative inquiry, this autonomous thinker and observer inside the head is nowhere to be found. In this practice, by leaving your eyes open, but by directing your attention to the mind, this conceptually superimposed demarcation between inner and outer begins to erode. You begin to recognize that your thoughts are not occurring in here in your head, nor are they occurring out there in space. This practice challenges the existence of an absolutely objective space of the physical senses that is absolutely separate from the subjective space of the mind. You are now on a path to realizing the meaning of non-duality. So just a couple of personal comments about that. When I first started meditating many years ago, I had a very agitated mind, and I found that even if I had my eyes slightly open, I was too agitating. So I, for quite some years, always meditated with the eyes closed, which helped reduce agitation. But of course, not so good for dullness. And so eventually I understood that, you know, even though agitation was reducing, I was quite dull. And when I was introduced to this practice and approach, then when I first started meditating with my eyes open, naturally open, I found that very uncomfortable. The first few times, very difficult. But actually, I got quickly used to it. And generally now, I only tend to meditate with my eyes naturally open. And I find a lot of benefit with that. One is that even though with the eyes open, you're not really looking at anything. And of course, in this practice, one thing we don't want to do is to deliberately unfocus the eyes, because that strains the eyes. So we're not trying to sort of cross the eyes or do, we're not trying to make it fuzzy, you know. Otherwise we're straining the eyes, so we don't want to do that. But we're just like, the example I gave earlier was, it's like vacantly resting your gaze in the space in front of you, as if you're daydreaming. You know, when we're daydreaming, you know, our eyes are there, but we're not really looking at what's in front of us because we're caught up in our daydream. A little bit like that. So relaxed. And even though we're not really looking at anything and the focus is the mind, the visual gaze is still somewhat engaged. And of course, visual gaze only happens in the present moment. So I find that having the eyes open helps me more to lock me into the present. It's a little bit harder for me to go into the past and the future because of that. And also, I find with the eyes open, the clarity is much better. Now, of course, here is not really ideal conditions having your eyes open, because particularly if there's people in front of you, they're moving, and then you easily get pulled by the movement around you. So what I can suggest is that when you're back home, is a good approach can be a little bit like the Zen approach, you know, have a blank wall in front of you. So there's no color or something to pull your visual gaze. No movement. So if you have a little candle flickering there, that's probably going to pull your attention towards it. And then what you can do is adjust the light according to your preference. Personally, I like it quite dim. So this is something that you can play with when you're at home. And then also with the gaze, you can adjust your level. Normally it's suggested just slightly downward. If you're finding that you're a little bit dull, you can like look straight ahead. Or if you find that you're getting a little bit agitated, is lower the gaze a bit. So this is something you can play with at home. And another trick that I find sometimes helpful is normally, again, with the eyes open, you know, the eyes are wandering, you know, we start looking all around. To help reduce that is pick a point in front of you, a little spot or something, and use that as a little bit of an anchor point. Of course, we're not really focusing on it, but keep that as an anchor, and that can help also with reducing the movement. But again, it's something just to get used to. And again, I found quite quickly I could get used to doing that. So that's some advice. And again, with the eyes open, in this practice of looking at the mind, as Alan Moss said, this sort of sense of inner and outer dissolve. Because when we have them closed, we really have a sense there's a me in here and the world out there. Whereas if you have the eyes open, this sort of artificial barrier between inner and outer often starts to collapse. And this, again, is going to be very helpful when it comes to this Vipassana practice of emptiness, because this emptiness experience is this non-dualistic experience. So this can really support that. So that's why it's recommended here. So any questions about this practice? Because then I'd just like to briefly mention the third practice that you're also going to start to do with Jonas later in the course, the resting in the awareness practice, the shamatha with no object. But before I go there, is there any questions about this practice? Okay. So let's briefly mention the third practice of shamatha. So this is called shamatha with no object, or sometimes called awareness of awareness practice. So again, I'd just like to briefly introduce it here, And then a couple more comments that may be helpful to you. So this is on page 131. He says, if you wish to continue in settling the mind in its natural state, this practice can take you all the way to the achievement of shamatha. But I shall now present an alternate practice you may find an even more potent way to balance your attention to perfection. Padmasambhava calls this technique the cultivation of shamatha without a sign. So again, Padmasambhava, of course, was a great Indian master who was instrumental in bringing Buddhism to Tibet initially. In this context, the term sign refers to any object of attention that can be identified within a conceptual framework. The tactile sensations of the breath are a sign. So is the space of the mind and the mental events that arise within that space. In both those practices, the attention is directed to an object other than itself, and stability and vividness, or clarity, are cultivated in relation to that object. In the practice of shamatha without a sign, the attention is not directed to anything. It rests in its own nature, simply being aware of its own presence. Nominally, you could say that awareness takes itself as its object, but experientially, this practice is more a matter of taking no object. You simply let your awareness rest without any referent in its own innate luminosity and cognizance. While Padmasambhava presents this as a method for achieving shamatha, it is also an effective method for illuminating the nature of awareness itself. So, in this practice, again, experientially, the mind practice experientially is you have a sense of being this witness or the observer who's observing the mind and all the thoughts coming up in it. Whereas in this practice, it's not so much looking at the mind, but rather being the mind. You're just resting in awareness itself. Of course, in this practice, you'll have all sorts of things coming up, thoughts, emotions, memories. But in this practice of awareness, we're not really interested in any of these appearances. Of course, we're not trying to get rid of them, but we're paying no interest in them. In the mind practice, of course, we are looking at them. We are observing them directly, arising and passing. Whereas in this practice, we're just simply not paying any attention to them. We're just simply resting in that awareness itself. Now, this is a very subtle practice, and many people find it quite difficult, but some people really are drawn to it naturally. And I've been introducing it a little bit into some of our meditations at the end, the last couple of minutes, where I've said, release all appearances, and simply allow the mind to come to rest in the present moment, to rest in awareness itself. So this practice is not so much about doing anything, but rather being, just resting in the mind itself, resting in awareness itself. And as I said, is a later in the course, in the morning meditations, the last couple of days, Jonas will briefly introduce you into that practice. I like that practice personally a lot, because again, it can really be a very nice little bridge into the Vipassana practice to really illuminate the nature of the awareness, you know, this idea of non-duality. You can really start to sort of experience this non-duality, and that can be very helpful in terms of our emptiness practice. So that's very briefly the awareness of awareness practice. So, is there any questions about that practice? Everyone's stunned. Okay, so maybe the thing to do is then just, again, to practice it a little bit later in the course with Jonas. And again, the recommendation for the shamatha practice is use the practice that works best for you, the object that works best for you. For most of us, I think that's going to be the breath. But now we're starting to work with the mind, and then towards the end, a little bit the awareness practice. And if you really find that the mind practice, even though it may be quite difficult, if you find that you can really use it and benefit, then just do that. Or even if you find that resting in awareness really works for you, you can use that as your shamatha practice.
Just one.
Yeah.
Is it like non-recommendable to just swap between the practices during one
session? Yeah. So of course, if we are really trying to do the shamatha practice, it's not so much recommended to keep swapping the object. Yeah. Having said that, what we can do, of course, is let's say we're using the mind as our normal object, but on a particular day we find that we're really just getting caught up, or we're really tense or agitated, then we can shift back for some minutes to focusing on the breath, maybe in the abdomen or the full body, to relax, 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 or to stabilize the mind, and then go back to the mind. So we can use that as a little bit of something to help us in certain circumstances. And also, of course, within the mind practice, in a beginning stage at least, we can tie that a little bit to the breath as well, in terms of this balancing act, is that when we are observing the mind, then to balance the mouth, to overcome the agitation, distraction, or dullness, we can conjoin a bit with the breath, meaning that we're looking at the mind, and then during the out-breath, when we're looking at the mind, we can relax, release grasping onto any thoughts, and just look at the mind, focus, and then return. And then on the in-breath, we can sharpen our focus on the mind. So we can do that balancing act in conjunction with the breath. So we can use the breath a little bit to support that practice. But again, I think if we do, 5 or 10 minutes of this, 10 minutes of that, keep swapping around, I think it's not really going to be effective. Of course, what we can do as a beginner is experiment with each of these practices for a while and see which one will work best for us. But then we need to select one and sort of stick with that. And again, having said that, what Alan Wallace also recommends is that for most of us, probably the breath is going to be the best practice as a beginner. But we could use the breath for some time, maybe weeks or months or longer, and progress away along the shamatha path, and our mind has become more stable, more clear. Then we can switch to using the mind or resting in awareness. But then we continue with that.
But I mean, for instance, I've been using breath for a couple of years, and I find it. And then sometimes I feel like I've experienced something like the awareness or of being in the no object meditation.
Mm-hmm.
But still, I can't start with that.
Yeah.
So I need the breath.
This is fine. So again, remember, to start the meditation, we need to prepare body, speech, mind. So you can use the breath as part of the preparation. And we do that in the meditations I'm leading, of saying to prepare the mind, just focus on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. But that's part of the preparation. So yes, to prepare the mind, to stabilize the mind, make it clear at the beginning, and we may spend 5 or 10 minutes doing that. Once we've done that, of course, then we can switch to using the awareness practice or whatever practice. Yes, this is completely acceptable. But if we're, doing the awareness practice for 10 minutes and we think, let's do the breath for another 10 and then the mind for 10, this, I think, is not going to be very helpful. Any other questions? Otherwise, I've just got a couple more pieces of advice about the practice and then it's time for lunch. Okay. So again, I've already mentioned, I think briefly, with any of these shamatha practices, expectations are going to just create all sorts of problems. So, of course, in any practice, we need to know the goal of the practice and how to do the practice. But then to have some sort of expectation of some sort of experience in that meditation is just going to create a lot of frustration, and it's going to sidetrack us in the practice. So we need to make sure that at the beginning of the meditation, if we have any sort of expectations or fears or worries or concerns, the opposite of the expectation is we need just let that go, let that go, let that go. In particular, with shamatha practice, it's said that when we're striving to shamatha, we are going to have three qualities that we are going to experience of mind. That as we achieve shamatha or approach shamatha, we're going to have these three experiences. That our mind will become much more clear, much more non-conceptual, meaning there won't be all this mental activity, and our mind will become very blissful or joyful. And all the meditation manuals warn meditators about these experiences. Because even now at the beginning stage of our practice, sometimes our mind can be very blissful, sometimes very clear, sometimes this sort of open spaciousness. And these experiences are very tempting because they're very nice experiences. So it's very easy to get caught up in these experiences and try to recreate them and grasp onto them. And I know from experience that grasping onto these sorts of experiences, trying to recreate them, just means that your practice is going to come to a grinding halt and you're going to have a lot of frustration. So if we have these experiences, like any sorts of experiences in this practice, is don't get caught up in it. So the general advice is do not get caught up in pleasant experiences by craving and attachment, and do not get caught up in strange or unpleasant experiences with aversion. Otherwise the whole practice will come to a grinding halt. And in the shamatha practice, because our mind, we are making the mind very calm, clear and focused, balanced, that will also have a good balancing effect on the body. And during that balancing process, you're going to notice all sorts of physical sensations arising. You know, very common is a lot of heat. Sometimes people feel like floating, big body, small body, heavy body, vibrations, tingling. All sorts of things will happen as the realignment process happens. Some of these experiences are very pleasant, some not so pleasant. Just let them be, let them be, let them be. Don't get caught up in them. Same with mental experiences such as this. And again, as we're doing the shamatha practice, you'll find a lot of these things that we've been suppressing our entire life will start to percolate to the surface. If we get caught up in these with aversion, we're just going to come to a grinding halt. So with all of these experiences, don't get caught up in them, with attachment and craving for the pleasant ones and aversion for anything strange or unpleasant. Just let them go, let them go, let them go. So that's the piece of advice I wanted to offer to maybe hopefully avoid a lot of unnecessary suffering and frustration. Right. So, of course, aspiration is coming from understanding the benefits of the practice. Whereas expectation is coming from hoping to have a certain experience. So expectation is about grasping or having attachment to some experience or result. So remember, and a way to overcome that is to understand a good meditation is any meditation simply where we try the best to our ability no matter what happens. If we have this idea, then We can understand that some days our mind is more calm and focused than other days. And so there's going to be a lot of variation in our practice in the short term. And therefore, not to have this thing where, oh, for the last 3 days I was very focused, so today it's going to be at least like that, if not better. If we have that expectation, I think we're just going to have a lot of unnecessary frustration. So again, by understanding the benefits, we will have aspiration, we'll want to do the practice, but then have the attitude of, we try our best, whatever happens is okay. And then we can let go of that expectation. And understand that this is a long-term thing, not a short-term. We're not trying to get some little experience in the short-term. Is think long-term. Yes, that's right, to have this inquisitive state of mind, and lots of things are going to happen in this journey, you know. Of course. Okay, last question, then we better go for lunch.
A lot of those explanations sound very complex on an intellectual level. So
which the ones I gave, particular? Yeah.
So I'm just wondering how much intellect you need. I mean, I suppose it's not about intellect, but at some point it seems like you need to grasp intellectually the concept before, you know.
Well, see, the thing is that with any practice, it's important to understand what the practice is and what we're trying to achieve and how to do that. Otherwise, we have no framework for meditation. Then we sit down and we go, well, what am I supposed to do? And if this happens, what do I do with that? And what am I really striving for? And then people just sort of go nowhere. So, you know, and with these practices, of course, that's why it's important to hear the instructions a number of times. And that's why it's important with any practice, if we really want to get into the practice and put a lot of effort into the practice. That's why I think briefly, Alan Moss mentioned briefly that it's important that the deeper we go into the practice, the more important to have a qualified teacher who can really guide us in this practice. Because the more deep we go into the practice, the more things will come up in the practice that we need to know how to deal with this, what to do with this. And so really it is very important that if we are making a commitment to doing a particular practice in depth, then a teacher can be very helpful. We can get feedback from them. Because again, it's often difficult, even if we have a good framework for practice, if something sort of comes up, you know, what is that and how do I deal with that, you know, particularly at a beginning level. As we progress in the practice, then of course, we can become more self-reliant. But I think this is what it's pointing to, is that I think a teacher can be very helpful in those initial phases. Okay, well, we better stop there. We've run over time. So let's break for lunch and we'll come back at 2:00.